Broadcasting from Manhattan Beach and the World Wide Web, you're listening to CHSR, HealthyLife.net.
As a service to our listeners, this program is for general information and entertainment purposes only. CHSRHealthyLife.net does not recommend, endorse, or object to the views, products, or topics expressed or discussed by show hosts or their guests. We suggest you always consult with your own personal, medical, financial, or legal advisor.
Greetings, or may I say bonjour in Potawatomi, to those joining us for today's Indigenous Perspective Show. I'm Randy Kritkowski, an enrolled Potawatomi tribal member and the co-host of Indigenous Perspectives.
And I'm Carolyn Schmidt, the other co-host. For our land acknowledgement, we recognize Vermont, where we are as part of Endakina, the unceded traditional territory of the Abenaki people, who for centuries have lived on the lands now included in present-day northern New England and southeastern Canada.
We also acknowledge that this is the unceded land of our other-than-human kin, the winged ones, the rooted ones, the four-legged ones, and the mountains and the rivers, who have been present on Turtle Island and have been partners and caretakers for countless millennia. They were here before any of the two-legged arrived, before the indigenous peoples who came over on the Beringian land bridge from Asia 15,000 years ago, and before the European two-legged arrived more recently.
Today's podcast of Indigenous Perspectives is titled Crawford Lake Tells Her Own Stories of the Anthropocene. Just as Native Americans would gather around a fire to share stories, we are gathering in the 21st century's virtual meeting place with our two guests, who are both philosophers and sociologists from Europe.
Perhaps more in the spirit of indigenous storytelling, we are each going to tell a variation on the same story, the story that Crawford Lake is trying to tell us. Contrary to popular belief, indigenous stories were not carved in stone and repeated over and over verbatim. They were adapted to the audience and to the needs of that audience as understood by the storytellers.
So now to introduce today's guests. Robert Braun is a senior researcher at the Institute for Advanced Studies in Vienna. He's also an associate professor of sociology at Masaryk University in Brno in the Czech Republic. Robert defines himself as a Central European diaspora Jew, born and raised in Hungary. In the 1920s, his grandfather, barred from Hungarian universities, was able to go to university in Czechoslovakia and then get a job in Romania, where he and his immediate family managed to survive the Holocaust. Robert notes that he is grateful to be teaching today in the same building at Masaryk University in Brno, where his grandfather was educated and received his degree. So, Robert, welcome to the show.
Well, it's my pleasure.
And Robert is joined by his friend and colleague, Richard Randell, who defines himself as an Australian of European descent, now living in Switzerland. Richard is a fellow at the Institute for Advanced Studies in Vienna and a senior researcher in the Department of Sociology at Masaryk University. Richard completed his PhD in sociology at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Richard notes that although he's lived outside Australia for much of his adult life, he's very aware of the impact of the British conquest and settlement of Australia on the Aboriginal people. He says, not only was the land stolen from the Indigenous inhabitants, but this entirely different world, the world and its metaphysics of Europe, was laid over above the world of the previous inhabitants. Richard, thank you and welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thank you, Carolyn and Randy.
So, how did Robert and Richard, two philosophers in University of Vienna, come to encounter Randy, a Native American in Vermont?
So, it began when I wrote a letter about Crawford Lake to a group of international scientists who had been studying this small lake in the forest in Canada's Ontario province. The scientists, geologists specializing in naming epochs in the Earth's history, had been working for a decade on the question of whether or not they had found evidence in Crawford Lake's sediments, which might suggest the planet's self-regulating systems had changed so much that a new era should be declared. They were on the verge of titling this new era the Anthropocene, in recognition that humans, Anthropos, had become a dominant influence, if not the dominant influence, in the natural world. I wrote a letter explaining my concerns about such a designation. The letter was distributed widely and rather quickly, much to my surprise.
So, Robert and Richard, how and when did Randy's letter come to your attention, and what were your thoughts and, more importantly, your interests in what a Native American had to say?
Actually, the story is that this is the body that Randy mentioned is called the Anthropocene Working Group, which is an official body to do what Randy described they were about to do. And the deputy head of that group is a friend of mine. He's a professor of geology here at the University of Vienna. And he, when received the letter, I'm not part of the Anthropocene Working Group, but I'm an STS scholar, science and technology studies scholar. And I worked with the Anthropocene Working Group to kind of understand the politics of this naming that Randy mentioned. And I was kind of observing what these guys were doing. And we had a lot of conversations about my take, their take, etc. And then Michael Weigrach is his name, the deputy head, he forwarded me the letter of Randy with a comment, "This is much more in your corner of the woods than it is in ours." And so I read the letter and thought, actually, Michael is right. This questions and calls to attention the politics of what these people are doing. And then I shared the letter with Richard, with whom we are actually working on questions of the Anthropocene, not exactly from a geological point of view. And then we said, wow, this is interesting, even more so because to much of our regret, we're writing about the Anthropocene and Anthropos and all this, but we don't know any indigenous persons. So why don't we try to get to know one? And so we reached out to Randy, who was, to our surprise, actually very open. And that's where and how the conversation started. And that's why we're here today.
Yeah, and you know, Robert, the original letter that Randy sent to the working group that was then sent to Robert. Robert, of course, forwarded it to me, and you know, and I looked at it, and so then we had some conversations, some discussions about it. And as Robert said, this is we saw that here's some guy who's interested in the same kinds of things that we are. And in fact, I don't know, maybe it's the last year. We've been, you know, writing about the Anthropocene. We have yet to get things really published about it. And we're interested in the politics of it. And we're also interested in the politics of the geologists. And the geologists think that they're not involved in politics at all. They're just doing geology, right? And that there's a thing called the Anthropocene and it's out there and they're, discovering it. And they think they've discovered something important in Lake Crawford. And we're not saying that they haven't. I think it's interesting. I mean, I think this is something that needs to be looked at, but, yes, we're interested, if you like, in the politics of what's going on, amongst these geologists.
Let me back up for a bit and spend a little time on the idea of the politics of naming, because I think this is getting to one layer of why there are these controversies. So why does the name Anthropocene, or what is it about giving something a name that becomes political and philosophical?
I can maybe say something quickly about it. I mean, just one of the things that are contentious about the name is, of course, it comes from anthropos, and from scene, which means recent. So this would be one of the geological epoch that we're in. And one of the reasons it's become a contentious name is that it suggests, if we think anthropos refers to all humans, it suggests that all humans are equally responsible for the environmental destruction and climate change and the ecological disasters that we're living in. So so the name has been criticized for that it suggests this. Sort of the road, I don't know if we want to discuss this today, perhaps it will come up, kind of the road that Robin and I have been going down is thinking that anthropos isn't really all humans, but we could think about anthropos as being, for want of a better word, Western humans, those who are part of a particular metaphysics of a metaphysical, well, they're in a world where they have a particular understanding of what humans are and what animals are and what nature are and what the difference of these things are. And so I think this is perhaps a place we could start with the politics of the Anthropocene.
Well, I think there are two things worth mentioning here. One, that the whole idea of the Anthropocene naming came up in 2000 in a contribution by Paul Crutzen, who is a meteorologist. And basically his concern was climate change or climate emergency. And he casually suggested that the impact of humans is so strong on the Earth ecosystem that geologists need to change the naming of what's called the geological timescale and introduce a new era. And what he suggested was that basically the beginning of this era has to be connected to technology, therefore the onset of the Anthropocene should be the beginning of the Industrial Revolution in the 19th century. And following up on what Richard said, part of what we're doing is do a little genealogy, so looking into the origin of this thing that Western man, that is anthropos, names stuff. And surprisingly, it is already in the story or the book of the Genesis, because if you might remember, the Genesis story goes like this. God formed out of the ground all the animals and all the birds in the air. Whatever the man called each living creature was then its name. Be masters of the fish, of the sea, the birds of heaven, and all the living creatures that move on earth. To you I give all the sea-bearing plants everywhere on the surface of the earth. So, actually, naming matters. And apparently giving human, that is Western human, the power of naming all the animals and all the seed-bearing plants already established the hierarchy that this Western man wanted for himself. I am the boss around here. I can name, therefore I can control, therefore I can eliminate, therefore, I can raise, if you don't take these words really to be the words of God, but these are stories that have been written down. Actually, they have been written down exactly the same time when the seeds and origins of Western philosophy, that is Plato and Aristotle, 500 before Common Era originates. So what Richard alluded to, that this is not all humans that we're talking about, but this is a very specific type of human, that is Western man, has its origins in both the origin story of the Genesis of Western man, that is Judaism and Christianity, etc., but also in Greek philosophy. So naming does matter.
So it seemed that this small lake in Ontario, Crawford Lake, which is obviously not its own name or its indigenous name either, she found herself in the midst of a controversy, or to be more precise, at least three controversies. The first was this vigorous debate within the Anthropocene Working Group, this international organization, about whether there was sufficient evidence to declare a new geological epoch. This was becoming heated, making headlines. There was another, too, there's another controversy that Randy caused when he claimed that the renaming Anthropocene risked erasing, or more precisely, overwriting an important narrative of pre-colonial indigenous life on the shores of Crawford Lake. And finally, there's a controversy that you two, Richard and Robert, were wading into about what constitutes modernity and what are the deep cultural and philosophical roots of those who create knowledge in a Eurocentric world. So, Richard and Robert will toss this to you first. How do you see these controversies? How are they connected? Give us some thoughts here.
But there's a fourth controversy, and it's worth mentioning that the Anthropocene Working Group is a group of geologists that was tasked officially by the International Association of Geology to name the Anthropocene, and that work for 12 years has been rejected a few weeks ago. So that's controversy number one within geology. And you may think, on the one hand, that scientists are able to determine through their theories and through their observations and so through their science what is and what isn't. So how does it happen that people discuss, debate, and then take a vote, and they vote about scientific matter and reject something by a majority vote? And then, of course, as it happens, and of course we're most of our listeners are probably in America, they know this happens after voting. Sometimes the person who loses challenges the vote. Surprise, surprise, it's not only politicians who do that, but also geologists do that. So the controversy went on and on. It's still ongoing today. So both sides, both the minority and the majority, write articles. This is their way of doing, write articles that actually they're right and the other party is wrong. And also the vote has been stolen and it was not legal, etc. So this is controversy number one. And then the rest, follows. Richard, maybe you want to take over.
Oh. Could you repeat the question again?
How are these different controversies entangled? I mean, is this the proverbial Gordian knot that we can't cut?
Yeah, okay. Yeah. No, I mean, I think, you know, the interesting thing about Crawford Lake, as you pointed out, it has an indigenous name. It has this European name, right? And I think, you know, this is another example, of, as we put it, Anthropos. Anthropos has power to decide what name, you know, this is about naming. This is about finding a place in which geologists believe we can identify this independently existing thing out there, which they've defined in a particular kind of way. It's not like we're trying to argue that there's no climate change, that there's no ecological destruction that's occurring, right? The interesting thing and the important thing is the particular way in which this has been defined. I mean, just briefly, most people think about the Anthropocene as being climate change, and it's got to do with greenhouse gases. And I think, you know, for many of us, it goes far beyond greenhouse gases.
To pick up on this, I think, on the one hand, in Carolyn's narrative, it seemed like there are three controversies. I think there is no three controversy. There is only one. And the one controversy is the last one that we're trying to address here. Because if you understand that, then the rest follows. So what we're trying to say here is that, as Randy started the show, naming matters, because naming is not just
putting a name that is a word on something, but actually it creates something, it constitutes something. And not only does it constitute something, it also institutes something through the power of constitution. And so the overwriting of the histories of Crawford Lake is exactly this process of constituting and instituting not only history, but instituting a whole world, with its furniture, with its people, with its way, two-legged and four-legged and other entities are seen, perceived, constituted. And when you think of Western worlds, you think that there are things in it, and these things are independent. There is Randy, there's Carolyn, there's Richard, and there's Robert, and there's a computer, and I hold a pen, and these are all different separate entities that interact with one another. But this is not necessarily the case. This is our way of seeing and our way of doing, and by our way of doing, we're instituting this as the only way things can be instituted. And I think what the fascinating thing here is that this is not so. Randy, go ahead.
I really love your fixating on the name. I don't know if you two are aware, but very recently the lake was renamed by the indigenous people who live there. They gave it a new traditional indigenous name, and it translated as, "We have a story to tell." And to some degree, I think they've been assimilated into the Anthropocene naming process, because part of what they're doing is saying, is our new story to tell the Anthropocene, or is the story of our indigenous settlement that was there? Or as you two are saying, and I think what this program is trying to say, there's an even bigger story about what's been going on for two millennia in Western culture, whereby now we call in indigenous traditions knowledge keepers, knowledge authenticators, lay exclusive claim to naming and determining whose notion of reality and how we get to know reality is the only way to do it. Robert, when you spoke, I guess it was a couple of weeks ago at your university in Vienna, you said you liked the scientific controversy. And I think it is a teachable moment. And I think that's what we're getting to in this broadcast is that unwittingly, the Anthropocene Working Group has given us something far, far more interesting than this very nerdy thing about what's in the strata in the lake. And that is to open a public dialogue, which I'm hoping we're breaking open today, about what's really going on behind the scenes and in the underlying philosophical expectations and assumptions.
So with that note, we'll take a pause. We'll throw a virtual log on our virtual fire, and we'll be back in just a minute. Stay tuned.
Rights for nature? Around the globe, indigenous communities, governments, and environmental groups are realizing that human rights aren't enough to protect the planet. They're passing laws that recognize rivers, forests, and mountains as having rights of their own, rights that include the right of those ecosystems to exist and flourish. These actions are beginning to make a real difference. Find out more about this work by visiting the Center for Democratic and Environmental Rights webpage at centerforenvironmentalrights.org.
Period poverty. If you don't know what it is, you should, because you can help. One in four American women struggle to purchase menstruation products this year, resulting in missed school and even loss of income. The Native American Women's Nonprofit, Kwek Society, cares enough to give Native American students and communities their period products, and they do it across North America. Please help women with your time, donations, or supplies to maintain their dignity and celebrate their strength during moon time. Visit kweksociety.org. That's Kwek Society.
Listen up. The source for information and inspirational items about the struggle and wisdom of indigenous people is the Syracuse Cultural Workers. They are committed to peace, sustainability, social justice, feminism, and multiculturalism, and they create beautiful visual materials like calendars, t-shirts, cards, and more, including their Greetings and Thanks to the Natural World accordion poster that offers daily grounding for our relationship to the earth and its many fellow beings. Get so many wonderful items. Go there now. SyracuseCulturalWorkers.com.
Randy Krakowski's book, Without Reservation, describes his spiritual awakening as a Native American. It's a powerful, life-changing story where Randy shares his journey into the realm of ancestral Native American connections and explores his encounters with Mother Earth. The book actually helps you how to reconnect with your ancestors to rekindle your access to ancestral wisdom and nature. Available in print, ebook, and audiobook format, Get Without Reservation by Randy Krakowski from all major booksellers. For more information, visit randykrakowski.com.
Citizen Potawatomi Nation's Cultural Heritage Center, located near Shawnee, Oklahoma, features 11 immersive galleries with digital and interactive exhibits. Visitors learn about the tribe's history from origin to modern days and gain an understanding of Citizen Potawatomi oral traditions and lifeways. Admission is always free. Open Monday through Friday from 8 a.m. to 5 p.m., Saturday 10 a.m. to 3 p.m. Visit the Cultural Heritage Center on the web at PotawatomiHeritage.com.
Welcome back to Indigenous Perspectives, and we're talking with our guests, Robert Braun and Richard Randell, about Crawford Lake and various issues. So, Randy?
So, I want to back up and give voice to Crawford Lake, let her tell a little bit more of her story, because apropos of my letter, she keeps getting buried in all this. So, for those of our listeners who haven't followed this controversy, Crawford Lake is an Ontario province. It's a very small lake. It's a very unusual lake. It's very deep, and the waters don't turn over. Sediments get deposited in the bottom layer after layer like tree rings, and they don't get oxygenated. They don't get disturbed. So there's a beautiful historical record of millennia of natural and human activity left as a marker in the bottom of the lake. So the question for the stratigraphers was, what can we learn from that? We would think from reading newspaper reports that the lake became famous and was studied because of its interest to geologists. The fact of the matter is that it was brought to geologists' attention by paleo historians, ancient historians of pre-Columbian settlement, who discovered there was pollen in the sediments at the lake they were looking at. And they became really curious about what had gone on around the lake because of the beautiful evidence of when the settlements began there and when they ended. So now my concern in my letter was this story of people living on the shores of the lake for hundreds of years in a very sustainable fashion in harmony with nature is being overwritten by another story of humans destroying the environment and dominating the environment. So the name was first changed to Crawford. It's been changed back by the indigenous people recently to this is a lake that has a story to tell. And now the question is, going forward, will we name the new area Crawfordian, as is the tradition? In other words, give the whole world this lake as a poster child for a new era for which it was not responsible and was a late victim? Your thoughts on that?
I think giving voice to a lake is very important. And interesting, because this is the gist of the problem. Even you, Randy, mentioned that there were humans and there were other entities living side by side on the shore of the lake. So how can we talk about things in a different way than we, white, European, Western humans, have constituted the world? Because maybe there are no humans separate and no crops separate, pollens separate, lake separate. But they're entangled in a strange relationality. And it's only our way of seeing and our way of thinking and our way of naming, to refer back to you, that makes these things as separate. And there are two issues here. One, what is, but also how can we talk about things? And you know, we're writing sophisticated papers with Richard, and sometimes our reviewers get back, we're doing philosophy, and our reviewers get back to us and say, please write in plain English. And we can't write in plain English, not because we don't know English, but because plain English is one way of naming. And it has a history why these reviewers want us to talk the language they understand, because they come from that specific tradition that we're criticizing. And it was Sylvia Vinter, actually a Jamaican writer, who once said that universities and so Western knowledge, Western science, is the biggest neo-colonizer. Universities are all about naming. Science is all about naming, but naming in a very specific way. And by naming, again, you are creating worlds. You are constituting, but more importantly, politically instituting worlds. And then claim that this is how the world is. Wow, I've only found it. I didn't do anything with it. It's out there. Crawford Lake is just a bunch of water that we can swim in. But Crawford Lake actually may exist in a totally different type of world in which other things are constituted and instituted. We can't even imagine it.
So, Richard, you're familiar with this. You come from a piece of land where there were people for countless tens of thousands of years.
85,000, in fact.
The white settlers showed up and started naming everything.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I think what I reflecting on this particular name of Crawford, I mean, the very fact that this lake has been given this name, this is an example of the Anthropocene. I mean, if one thinks about the Anthropocene as a period in time where Western humans and their metaphysics, so the kinds of things that Robert was talking about Genesis and animals and nature and humans, and humans are, you know, sovereign power, and there are all these other things that are less important than us, right? And like Crawford is an example of, is in a place, namely North America, just like Australia, where Anthropos has come, with this particular world. And the very fact that this lake is called Crawford, is an example of the Anthropocene. If we think about the Anthropocene, not just in terms of climate, but of essentially this colonial power, which has come and created a completely new form of life in Australia. Look, I'm not, I don't want to make out, that I know a lot about, Indigenous Australians, but, Australia is very much like the United States. People live in suburbs, private property is owned. So just like in the United States and Europe, people own the land. And I think, Australia, for Indigenous Australians, the land isn't something that you own. You don't own it in some private way. You belong to the land. So, you know, these are different ontologies. As I said, I'm not going to make out that I know a lot about, Indigenous Australian ontologies. I guess I know a little bit. But it's very different, clearly, from the particular world that, has been created. And Crawford is an example of that. Just the very fact that this lake has this name.
Well, what's
interesting, just one second to add to what Richard says. Maybe our listeners think that, you know, this is academic talk and it's maybe relevant for history or maybe relevant for academics in universities. But actually what's interesting is that there is another controversy going on, and that controversy is whether lakes or rivers have human rights. And not because you pollute a river, and then through that, humans die. But because they have an independent existence, and they have a right to exist as they are. So this is something that matters today in our own life.
So thank you for that. We'll take another break, throw another log on the fire, and return. Stay tuned.
Rights for nature? Around the globe, indigenous communities, governments, and environmental groups are realizing that human rights aren't enough to protect the planet. They're passing laws that recognize rivers, forests, and mountains as having rights of their own, rights that include the right of those ecosystems to exist and flourish. These actions are beginning to make a real difference. Find out more about this work by visiting the Center for Democratic and Environmental Rights webpage at centerforenvironmentalrights.org.
Randy Krakowski's book, Without Reservation, describes his spiritual awakening as a Native American. It's a powerful, life-changing story where Randy shares his journey into the realm of ancestral Native American connections and explores his encounters with Mother Earth. The book actually helps you how to reconnect with your ancestors to rekindle your access to ancestral wisdom and nature. Available in print, ebook, and audiobook format, Get Without Reservation by Randy Krakowski from all major booksellers. For more information, visit Randy Krakowski.
Located near Shawnee, Oklahoma, Citizen Potawatomi Nation is Potawatomi County's largest employer with a rich history and culture as a sovereign Native nation. Learn more about CPN by visiting its website, which includes information on services for members, tribal enterprises, government and constitution, the newspaper, and much more. All at potawatomi.org. That's PotawatomiOrg.
Period poverty. If you don't know what it is, you should, because you can help. One in four American women struggle to purchase menstruation products this year, resulting in missed school and even loss of income. The Native American women's nonprofit, Kwek Society, cares enough to give Native American students and communities their period products, and they do it across North America. Please help women with your time, donations, or supplies to maintain their dignity and celebrate their strength during moon time. Visit kweksociety.org. That's K-W-E-K Society.
Don't get angry. Anger is a negative emotion that suppresses your immune system that may cause health problems. Make a positive difference by working together to protect and support your family, friends, and community. Take a break from the dark side. Uplifting and enlightening. Listen to the positive side of podcasts. HRNradio.com.
Way higher.
Welcome back to Indigenous Perspectives. We've been talking about the power of naming, and now we're linking also to the power of if you name something, then you are overwriting its previous names and everything associated with that. So, Richard, take us from there.
Yeah, okay, that's really interesting. I thought what I'd do here is just share an experience I had when I was in Australia in September last year. I hadn't been back to Australia for quite a long time. And I think this is about erasure, but not entirely erasure, but a covering up of something else. It's not just covering up with names, but an entirely different world. So anyway, I was lying in bed one night in Adelaide, which is the city that I'm from in Australia. And I was thinking, you know, here I am. I'm in this house in a suburb in this which is a piece of private property, and it's got a yard and a lawn, and it's a very nice Australian, you know, house and garden. And I think underneath here, however, there's another world, right? There's the world of the people who used to be here. And I was thinking, it's there. It's been covered over, but there's still a trace. It's a very difficult to explain it, but I felt like, you know, I can feel this, that there's something there. Just because there's something on top of it, it doesn't mean that what was there before has completely disappeared. You know, so this is sort of, you know, coming to think about it, it's kind of how I think maybe about Crawford Lake. I mean, Crawford Lake is also a layer that's been imposed upon another thing, right? And for the geologists, they're just interested in this, you know, most recent layer, but underneath those layers are, as you pointed out, pollens from other peoples and before humans even came to North America. There's there are other worlds behind that are you know, below these layers that are above it. So that's how I make sense of your question.
So the question that came up the other night with this group of people who were interested in my indigenous perspective on reconnecting with the past and with our ancestors is, when I have, Randy, the kind of experience that you, Richard, just described, what am I supposed to do when I look in the mirror and I say, was that real? Am I crazy? Am I imagining it? How do I push back on the culture that is so deeply ingrained and so deeply socialized into me that I feel, now I'm putting words in their mouths, I feel like I've been through a residential school that told me to get rid of all this spiritual dimension to my life. You know, how do we help mainstream people, no less indigenous people, recover that kind of courage and ability to own and trust their own direct experience of the world, which isn't mediated by all of this naming and all of this overwriting? How do we do that for them?
Well, first and foremost, I think before we engage with indigenous peoples, I think we should engage with ourselves, that is Western white Europeans, and understanding and confronting the fact that for these past 2,000, 3,000 years of from the Genesis story and Greek philosophy, we're trying to inscribe the names that we think are right as the real. Actually, we're not naming. We are just putting words on things that exist independent of us. So we should tell ourselves and the people who believe it that maybe this is not so. And if our audience thinks that we're the bright geniuses who say this for the first time, this has 100 years of tradition, even in Western thinking. It's called phenomenology. Edmund Husserl, who is the founder of the phenomenological school of philosophy, already 120 years ago questioned this objectivity of the world out there and called attention to the experiential, that is the entanglement of the human and the world together forming what is real. So I think we have work to do there. And if somebody thinks that this is all philosophy and this is a mystical spiritual experience, is actually Western science, and this will be a long jump, Western science, quantum theory, at least one interpretation thereof, says exactly the same thing. Quantum theory, which is, you know, has positioned itself as the utmost scientific endeavor of the 20th and the 21st century, actually says the same thing, that in the end of the day, there is nothing out there but what is constituted by the entanglement of the observer and the object of observation and the phenomena, this togetherness of the observer and the observed constitutes things. And Hugh Everett, physicist, quantum theorist, whom I adore, died unfortunately in the 50s, came up with what's now called the many worlds interpretation of quantum theory. He thinks that there are many worlds, but these worlds shouldn't be imagined as separate physical entities living, staying side by side. But these worlds are here. All of them are here with us in this space, or rather constituting innumerable spaces. And the space of Crawford Lake is one of them. And the other space of Western theory is another one. And there can be many others.
So my letter to the Anthropocene Working Group may have been misunderstood, and at the time I may not have been as clear as I can be now, thanks actually to both of you. What I really feel is that there is nothing, quote, wrong with what the Anthropocene Working Group is doing. It's rock solid science in its own narrow way. What bothers me, apropos of what you just said, is that they've ignored the other story that the lake is telling about another world in which people lived, and another alternative we have to throwing up our hands and saying it's game over for Mother Nature, which is to go back to the values and the mindset of indigenous people who found a way of living a little more gently on the face of the earth. So I see this wonderful moment in time that was given to us by the Anthropocene Working Group stumbling into the politics and the cultural sensitivities of this as our opportunity to alert people to what I understand you're saying, which is to be aware of a multiverse. And what the Anthropocene is a choice about how we proceed. It is not condemning us to live in the world that those little markers on the lake would signal as the end.
So we're about to take another break, and we'll be back.
Rights for nature? Around the globe, indigenous communities, governments, and environmental groups are realizing that human rights aren't enough to protect the planet. They're passing laws that recognize rivers, forests, and mountains as having rights of their own, rights that include the right of those ecosystems to exist and flourish. These actions are beginning to make a real difference. Find out more about this work by visiting the Center for Democratic and Environmental Rights webpage at centerforenvironmentalrights.org.
Period poverty. If you don't know what it is, you should, because you can help. 1 in 4 American women struggle to purchase menstruation products this year, resulting in missed school and even loss of income. The Native American Women's Nonprofit, Kwek Society, cares enough to give Native American students and communities their period products, and they do it across North America. Please help women with your time, donations, or supplies to maintain their dignity and celebrate their strength during moon time. Visit kweksociety.org. That's K-W-E-K Society.
Listen up. The source for information and inspirational items about the struggle and wisdom of indigenous people is the Syracuse Cultural Workers. They are committed to peace, sustainability, social justice, feminism, and multiculturalism, and they create beautiful visual materials like calendars, t-shirts, cards, and more, including their Greetings and Thanks to the Natural World accordion poster that offers daily grounding for our relationship to the earth and its many fellow beings. Get so many wonderful items. Go there now. SyracuseCulturalWorkers.com.
Randy Krakowski's book, Without Reservation, describes his spiritual awakening as a Native American. It's a powerful, life-changing story where Randy shares his journey into the realm of ancestral Native American connections and explores his encounters with Mother Earth. The book actually helps you how to reconnect with your ancestors to rekindle your access to ancestral wisdom and nature. Available in print, ebook, and audiobook format, Get Without Reservation by Randy Krakowski from all major booksellers. For more information, visit Randy Krakowski.
Citizen Potawatomi Nation's Cultural Heritage Center, located near Shawnee, Oklahoma, features 11 immersive galleries with digital and interactive exhibits. Visitors learn about the tribe's history from origin to modern days and gain an understanding of Citizen Potawatomi oral traditions and lifeways. Admission is always free. Open Monday through Friday from 8 a.m. to 5 p.m., Saturday 10 a.m. to 3 p.m. Visit the Cultural Heritage Center on the web at PotawatomiHeritage.com.
Where positive people and radio unite. HealthyLife.net.
Welcome back to Indigenous Perspectives. And Richard, you're going to start us off.
Okay. So, yeah, I wanted to take up what you just said, Randy. And, you know, I think the interesting thing is Robert talked about many worlds and Everett, and you talked about Indigenous worlds and so forth. I think the interesting thing about this particular world that is the Anthropocene is there's a belief there that there is actually only one world. There is only one world. There's all kinds of, you know, perhaps different cultures. They have different understandings and different perspectives of it, but there's one world. And I think this is precisely, what the problem is here. And also, if you think there's one world and you think there's this one world that's out there and that it's separate from you, and this is perhaps how it affects all of us in a profound way, is you're essentially alienated from all of existence. Existence exists out there, and you're just a subject, and you look at it, and you either get it right or you get it wrong, and Western science thinks it gets it the right way. But the more important thing is that much of Western science, with the exception of quantum theory, which Robert mentioned, is of the view there's one world and it's out there, and it's independent from us. So that's, if you like, the existential situation that we find ourselves in, completely alienated from the rest of the universe.
So what are some ways to make ourselves feel less alienated?
Well, first and foremost, maybe start with not calling yourself indigenous. Everybody's indigenous. Because once you name yourself, get back to naming, once you name yourself indigenous, you're bringing up a whole culture of being victim of, and also affording someone else determining who you are. And I think we're all indigenous. We're all born and try to make sense of our being, the most important thing is not to accept one version of the facts. Facts are multiple. And this is the politics of it. That's why, Randy, you referred to this. I love controversies. And I love controversies because they point to, even within science, that there are various versions of facts. Therefore, there are various versions of worlds. And if Crawford Lake could talk, which it can, actually, because that's another thing, that maybe it's not only plain English, our language, that is the way of talking, but Lake's talk. And maybe not even Lake's talk, but there is word and world out there. So we might rather want to listen to what's going on out there, because by thinking that lakes talk, we have already created something, a lake. But maybe there is more buzz that we could listen to. And this is a conversation we had with Richard. What's the Zen Kuan asks, what's one hand clapping? And one hand clapping is silence. But silence is full of sound. And maybe, indigenous or not, we should, before talking, we should learn to listen better.
I love what you just said, and I think we could do a whole program. We could do a whole yearly series on quote listening, because listening isn't just with your ears. It's sometimes listening with your eyes, your ears, your skin, all the different ways we get neurological information. What we're just learning about, it affects the gut, the heart, the spine.
And you think that you're now not talking scientific language. There is a biologist actually called Rupert Sheldrake, who talks about morphic resonance. Memory is not in your head. Memory is all over the place. So when you experience, as you just described, through your skin, etc., you're experiencing also the memory of the world. that's out there somehow in this morphic resonance. That's what I meant by listening, exactly as you described, not only with the ear.
Yeah, but it's also, it's a profound effort at decolonization for anyone to reject the pressures of the dominant societies, the Western empirical private property, et cetera, world that we have, to get in touch with all these other realities.
I would like to think that indigenous people talking about decolonization, which is it's become a slogan that makes me a little uncomfortable, but I would like to think that this conversation that indigenous people have started is enormously useful to mainstream people, because as we found the other night, and as I have found in my own recent history, shedding, you know, this veil that was dropped over our ability to see, is an enormously difficult process. You know, the work I did in graduate school as a sociologist, Richard, you know, being trained to be an empirical sociologist, it took me decades to get out from under it. And sometimes I feel like graduate school did to me what residential schools, three of them, couldn't do to my grandfather. You know, and, you know, I'd like to think of myself as an independent thinker, but it's only recently that I realized, no, I was just reprogrammed, and more thoroughly and more deeply in many ways than he was, because he and his generation were together and they were fighting back. You know,
Absolutely. I mean, I think this is the other belief that, you know, we're independent selves. You know, we're entangled with the world, and we're made into particular types of people. I have a little anecdote I can tell about sociology. When I was at Wisconsin, Ram Dass gave a talk. He was previously Richard Alpert. He was connected with Timothy Leary and the whole psychedelic period. But Leary and Alpert were both professors at the Harvard School in the Department of Social Relations. Talcott Parsons, who was a famous sociologist, was head of the department. And Leary and Alpert and another person, Ralph Metzner, were all fired. And anyway, Richard Alpert kind of, you know, then became interested in Buddhism. And anyway, in this talk, he said, in my previous existence as a, you know, professor of psychology, he said, we used to believe that if something couldn't be measured, it wasn't real. And then he said, as you can imagine, we lived in a very puny universe. Right. So he was making the point that all these people live in this world where if you can't measure it, it doesn't exist.
I hate to do this, because we'd obviously love to keep sitting around the virtual fire and bringing up more topics, but we are coming to the end of our program. Hopefully for listeners, readers, you've enjoyed Crawford Lake Tells Her Own Stories of the Anthropocene, and our guests, Robert Braun and Richard Randell.
Yeah, I hope this broadcast has given you something to think about, and an opportunity to reconnect with your own roots in Mother Earth, and maybe even your ancestral roots. Before your busy day distracts you and sweeps you away, we encourage you to reach out and feel the presence of living flora, fauna, or animate kin, and perhaps even that of your ancestors who have walked on. Allow yourself to touch their presence, capture that moment, and hold on to it.
And if you wish, write to Randy. Let him know about your experiences, or with any questions or suggestions you have for these shows. Randy can be reached at his email, randykritkowski@hushmail.com.
Thank you so much, Miigwech, to our two guests and to our listeners.
Thank you very much.